What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Welcome back to New Books in Sociology. I'm Sarah Patterson, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I'll be speaking with Richard Osijo about his book, Masters of Craft, Old Jobs in the New Urban Economy. Thanks for joining us today, Richard.
Thank you for having me, Sarah. Nice to be here.
Thanks again for joining us. I was wondering if you can tell us more about yourself.
Sure. Well, I'm an associate professor of sociology at John Jay College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. I got my PhD from CUNY, from the Graduate Center in 2009. I'm a native New Yorker and up until October lived in the city my entire life. Now I live a little bit upstate.
Thank you and welcome again. How did this book come about for you?
Well, I was doing research for my dissertation. It was a project that I conducted that became my first book that was on conflict and tension over growth policies in gentrifying neighborhoods. And specifically, I was examining issues that had emerged between residents and business owners in an expanding nightlife scene in downtown Manhattan. So as a result, I was frankly going to a lot of bars to conduct my research and to learn a little bit more about nightlife culture, the people who went there, and the people who own these businesses. And a part of my research was to attend these community meetings where a very vocal group of residents went to protest these bars, specifically to protest their liquor licenses. And it was just a really interesting setting to observe these tensions in action. And at one particular meeting, this was in 2007, at one of these meetings, there were two items on the agenda for these bars that residents had especially turned out in large numbers to protest against. One was a bar called Milk and Honey, or at least the owner of Milk and Honey wanted to open up another business, but nobody was discussed. And the other was a bar called Death and Company. And they're both, one was in the East Village, the other in on the Lower East Side, right next to each other, really, these neighborhoods. And they were just so against these bars. And anytime the residents were against these bars, I always wanted to go and check them out just to see what they were all about. And they had all sorts of reasons for not wanting them there, which I go into in the book. I won't go into it now. So I went to these bars maybe a week later to talk to the owners and just to know what they were all about. And I was just kind of blown away as soon as I walked in by what I was observing. They were these high-end, very specialized cocktail bars. And they had hidden doors, the inconspicuous facades. They were very dark, candlelit, jazz playing, sweet aromas and weird sounds coming from the bartenders while they were making these drinks in a very precise manner, measuring things very exactly, using ingredients I'd never heard of, making drinks I'd never heard of. And it was just very unusual, and I'd never really experienced it before. And I decided that I was going to get what I needed for my dissertation project, learn more about their, you know, attitudes towards their neighbors and the neighborhood and everything, and also conduct a little side project because I was just fascinated by it. And I learned that these bars in particular were really at the heart of a cocktail revival cultural movement that was going on in New York City, in the U.S., and in other cities around the world. They were destinations for people who were really interested in making cocktails in a very specific way in the revival of the golden age of the cocktail, which was from around, you know, 1870s or so to 1920, up until Prohibition, that was being revived. So I kind of started this project, this side project on the cocktail world, and I just kind of followed the cocktail everywhere. So I went to various events and seminars and tastings and competitions, and just really went, and of course went to all these different cocktail bars. And related to that, I started conducting research on the liquor industry, which was very connected to the cocktail world. These bartenders were really interested in using new products to make unique tastes and to make new drinks with new flavor profiles. So they really needed a lot of the new product that were coming out of the liquor industry, which included the craft distilling industry. So these smaller businesses that had opened up to make these new unusual products for the market, but also for cocktail bartenders to use. So I started working at one of these craft distilleries north of New York City. And it was there that I realized that, you know, what I was most interested in was the work that these people were doing. It was the workers themselves who were creating not just these products, but the meanings and the new symbols that were being attached to these products, symbols of quality, of authenticity, of why the way that they make these products is the quote-unquote the correct or the right or the good way of making them. And those workers were the bartenders themselves and the distillers themselves. So then I just shifted the project and really turned it into really a work study and why people choose to do these jobs. Specifically, why do people who have other options for work choose to do these jobs? They were people who had college degrees. They were people who had professional backgrounds. And I just kind of got just fascinated by that general question and larger questions of the direction that work is going in today, in today's shifting economy. So I looked for these other cases to study. I didn't want to just study the booze world. So I found these barbershops that I had been familiar with a little bit. These upscale men's barbershops that had opened up in the city, and I was just interested in the men's grooming industry and fashion industry in general and style. And then I wanted a fourth case in somewhere in the food world, just because of its popularity and the close parallels that I was seeing with the other jobs that I was studying. I didn't want to study chefs just because I didn't want to do research in kitchens. They're not very hospitable places. So I had heard about the craft butchery movement, the whole animal, nose to tail butchery movement, and decided I was study butchers, and that's how that project evolved.
Great, thank you. Well, let's get right into the book. I really like how you open the book with a description of Chelsea Market and how that sort of illustrates the concepts of your book. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about that.
Yeah, Chelsea Market is where the butcher shop that I studied is located. And it's also where you can find all the other jobs and all the other products and services that I studied. And it just kind of represented, I felt, a really interesting microcosm for everything that was going on that I had been studying. So Chelsea Market was an old factory. It was the Nabisco factory, in fact. That's where the Oreo cookie was invented, for instance. And its thing was mass production of baked goods. That's what it did. It closed in the mid-20th century when basically it wasn't fit to produce at a volume that they required. They moved out to New Jersey, to the suburbs. Eventually, they would move even further to find more cheaper land and to find cheaper labor. This is just a common deindustrialization story. And the buildings that made up Chelsea, that made up the factory, were more or less abandoned over the several decades. And then you come to the 1990s, where we get this resurgence in interest in the core of cities, of old industrial cities. We find active reuse start to become popular. We find people who are interested in these old industrial spaces start to get revalorized. And so Chelsea Market got converted into a place for business, commercial businesses, and for office space upstairs. So they created the concourse in the middle that people could walk through. It kind of like became a fancy food court that got themed around industrial motifs and designs and so on. And originally it was a place for wholesale business, but then you get the food revolution, the boom in interest in all things culinary, and the origins and the processes that go into making food. And then you start to get the foodie destination label that it started to get. And the butcher shop that I worked at was definitely a big part of that. So Chelsea Market, to me, it really kind of encapsulated all the different elements of what I was seeing in these different jobs. It had the cultural aspect, shifts in how we classify taste, things that we consider to be of high quality or low quality, right? Or highbrow versus lowbrow. Some of the more lowbrow and common and everyday products that we consume were starting to become elevated a little bit. So buying meat started to shift, and not just buying meat, but what kind of meat you bought started to shift for what was considered to be of a high quality. To the urban, right? The idea that Chelsea Market was part of this gentrification process, this reinvestment that was going on in these formerly derelict, dangerous and poor neighborhoods, as well as just an interest in cities as destinations and places as destinations for consumption. And then just the economic, just the idea that work was really shifting, that these neighborhoods that were transforming were getting a new type of urbanite who were moving to these neighborhoods in search of certain consumption experiences. And just the idea that work itself was shifting, and that people who did have options for where to work wanted to do jobs like the ones that you could do in Chelsea Market, like in a food job or a retail job, that was no longer a bad job, but was something that allowed you to pursue a passion or pursue an interest of some sort, while also being in various ways creative and using your mind, not just being a passive retail worker. So I started the book with the story of Chelsea Market and all the different ways that it connects to these major factors, because it was just a perfect microcosm. It just kind of encapsulates all these different forces that are going on throughout society, all within this one place, specific place.
Great. Thank you. You start off the book by talking about bartenders and this sort of cultural renaissance around cocktails and the tie to prohibition and the professional art of bartending. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about that.
Sure. Well, the bartenders today, the cocktail bartenders today, to them, history is very important, the history of their, what they consider their trade, their craft. And they're really looking back to this golden age that I mentioned a bit earlier, of when bartenders were considered, as they claim, to be these skilled tradesmen who had to apprentice, had to memorize hundreds of recipes, had to innovate, had to come up with their own recipes, their own ingredients, their own liqueurs, and they held on to these things like trade secrets, pretty much. And they were respected for the knowledge that they possessed, for the skills that they possessed. And this had a decline after Prohibition. Prohibition wipes out alcohol sales and production, and the skilled tradesmen couldn't ply their trade. So they fell into a period that they call the Dark Ages, that today's bartenders call the Dark Ages, when the bartender became de-skilled, it became de-professionalized, if you will, and became a job that you just kind of did. You just kind of did it, say, because you were interested in pursuing something else more as a career. Your professional path was to become an artist or to become a musician or an actor or something else. You were bartending because you were pursuing something else, or you were bartending because that's kind of all you were qualified to do, or it's just something that you fell into. It wasn't something that you took pride in pursuing as a career. And so that idea that the bartender is a respected, noble occupation that requires skill and talent is what they've really revived and turned into their own form of professionalizing and professionalization.
Great, thank you. You move into a discussion of distilleries, and your book has lots of social contrasts, but here, one of the interesting social contrasts was in this idea of the hillbilly distillery versus what distilleries are today. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about that.
Yeah, and that was really interesting because when we talk about the revival of these different occupations, the distilling, I mean, what were the popular images that they had to really go on? It was most recently, it's the idea of the, you know, the hillbilly in the mountain making moonshine, right? Typically a poor, at best working class pursuit or activity that these folks like in Appalachia and so on engage in to try to earn some kind of living. And that's one of the big prevailing images, I guess, that we have of distilling, because before Prohibition, distillers were pretty ubiquitous. Every farm, more or less, would have had a still, and they would have distilled their products that they didn't bring to market or weren't going to bring to market and just sell the booze. And that was a really lucrative way for them to supplement their business. Then that ends during Prohibition, and you get again, this decline in distilling in the U.S., it gets concentrated in a few large corporations, more or less. And then once this craft starts to come back, the only real comparison then is with the illicit underground distillers, who are these, you know, low-income, mostly poor rural folks. But what was interesting is that a lot of the craft distillers kind of embrace this kind of outlawish image or quality to distilling. It's always had this kind of underground, against the law or outside the law kind of vibe to it. And while what they're doing now is very well funded and it's very well branded and marketed and everything done is done very deliberately with a particular goal in mind, in many ways they've kind of embraced that outlaw sensibility that has been attached to distilling all these years, even though what they're doing is functionally very similar. But in terms of an enterprise and in terms of something that is a cultural project, is remarkably unique from what these folks have been doing and are still doing.
Great, thank you. In your discussion of barbershops, you have a really interesting discussion of doing masculinity, as well as how barbershops are a place that barbers can sort of teach adult skills to their customers. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about that.
Yes, absolutely. So the barbershops were fascinating because they were really opened, again, very deliberately by folks who wanted to create a more traditional masculine space for men, particularly urban professional men, who had to achieve a certain style and a certain look for their jobs or for their everyday lives, but wanted them to be able to do that, to achieve this look without compromising their masculinity. There weren't really any typical barbershops, classic barbershops, where they could do that. If they wanted to get that, achieve that look and get that high-end service, they had to go to the women's salons. And that's a problem because, you know, that's where your masculinity is compromised. That's where you can't, you know, be a man, so to say. So they really kind of created these hybrid businesses that combine those different elements, the high-end service and body work with the more traditional, typical masculine space, the masculine environment. And for the barbers, they discovered that a lot of their clients, they felt, had to be taught what this actually meant, what style meant, what being a man meant, what being an adult meant. And so I really saw a lot of cases where the barbers were really taking it upon themselves to really teach them and show them how to be comfortable in their own bodies, specifically through their hair, but sometimes in other ways too, such as, you know, in terms of their facial hair or in terms of their clothing or something like that. And they really just tried to teach them to be comfortable in their own skin, to be comfortable being men. And what was fascinating was that they were doing it through a lot of what we consider to be feminine work, through a lot of high touch, high personal body work, obviously, that goes on with any barbershop, really, but was really accentuated here because it was so stylized and the techniques they used were just so in-depth and detailed, but also socially in terms of how they were talking to them about what they should be doing with their hair, how they should be carrying themselves and how they should be presenting themselves in front of people. So there was this really interesting masculinity project that was going on, this almost like this caring masculinity that they were really demonstrating for their clients within this space.
Great, thank you. In your discussion of the butcheries, one of the interesting aspects is this idea of good taste as well as the cultural performance of being a foodie. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about that.
Yeah, for the butchers, I noticed how really important it was for them because they were selling the whole animal. They had this economic reality, really, this financial reality that they had to sell the whole animal in order to make a profit. But beyond that, they all had this idea, this philosophy that we should be consuming the whole animal, that is one of the ways to be an ethical consumer, is to be based on this principle of not wasting anything. And combined, you could see that they were starting to really, really shift our understanding of taste and what is considered to be good meat. And there were, as a result, you're going to get certain very highly regarded products that are going to decline a little bit in status. And part of that, again, is the financial incentive. There's only so much filet mignon you can get out of a cow. So they're going to run out. And if they run out, then they have to sell something else. So there is that impetus there. But also, there's the idea that, well, the filet mignon's really not that good of a cut of meat anyway. It simply became popular because it's relatively easy to consume and to cook. It's relatively tasteless, and it, you know, doesn't have a ton of flavor, and it's just very simple to prepare. So they started shifting their attention to other cuts of meat on the animal, which, again, they have to sell, but also because they think that these cuts of meat have been ignored and thrown away, but they have a remarkable amount of flavor. They're more versatile when it comes to preparing certain dishes, and they started to try to influence their customers to think about taste in this way, to think about it less as something that you should like, right? A cut of meat that you should like. Why? Because that's just the way it's always been. And you should like a cut of meat for other reasons, because you should be consuming other parts of the animal, and you should not just do it because it's ethical, but you should do it because, hey, it actually tastes a whole lot better. So it was there that I really noticed this reconfiguration of taste and reclassifying material objects and products from how they've typically been understood.
Great, thank you. So the first half of your book is sort of going through each of these jobs individually, and then the second half is sort of this big picture analysis. And one of the first big pictures that you come to is this idea of what is a cool job, and as well as the search for meaning among the workers who do these jobs, but also the privilege that they have that allows them to hold these jobs. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about that.
Yeah, and that goes back to what I originally found really interesting about these folks who were pursuing these jobs, and that is that they have to be doing them, that they had other options for work because they usually went to college or they had some other kind of professional experience in another industry. And sometimes that wasn't very much experience, but still they had some kind of entry-level type of position in a more, you know, traditional firm for somebody of their background. So they didn't have to be doing it. So that was like my puzzle was, you know, why are they doing it? Why are they pursuing these jobs? And yeah, they all had the privilege to pursue them because they could always fall back on something else, whether it be their college degree or the networks that they had established professionally at that point. And now I really learned that the reason why they wanted to pursue them, well, first, like you say, with the so-called, I guess, gentrification of these jobs, they didn't want to just pursue any old version of them, and they wouldn't have pursued any old version of them. They didn't want to be the barber at the neighborhood barbershop. They wanted to be the barber at the cool barbershop that was going to challenge them, that was going to lead them to really enhance their barbering skills or learn very enhanced and advanced barbering skills and share their knowledge and their sense of style with these folks. So they looked for these more high-end jobs when they realized that they were going to pursue their passions. And that was a big part of it because they all had this idea that work should be something that is meaningful, that it should be something that is fulfilling, more like a vocation than a job. So if we think of people pursuing their interests in their spare time or in their free time on weekends or at nights or something like that, these folks were not interested in that. They were interested in turning their interests and their passions into some sort of viable career. And they didn't necessarily see that in the more conventional paths that people take, say, when they're in college or when they're done with college. So they just kind of took the plunge, really, or they were kind of drifting around and weren't entirely sure what exactly they were going to be doing. And they found these jobs in different ways through these different pathways and different networks that they had established and decided to really take that risk to enter into them and try to turn these jobs into careers. And the fact that they did it in these more high-end elite versions of these jobs, not in the more common versions of these jobs that we see, is really what's allowed them to experience them as something that is not a form of downward social mobility for people of their backgrounds and of their social class standing, because it's not really seen that way. These jobs really allow them to use their minds, to use their creativity, in addition to being able to use their bodies and use their hands, while also being social and sharing their knowledge and ideas and their skills with a public, with other people. So it's really the combination of those aspects of what these jobs are all about that, one, really leads to this bifurcation or gentrification of these industries, and also leads these workers to see them as possibly viable career paths that they could take. And again, you know, while they're seen as cool, I kind of expected also to find that they pursued them because they thought they were cool, And I didn't really find that. I figured they would, when I started out, that they would be just kind of having fun and doing this out of some sort of hipster's sense of irony. Like, oh, look at me doing this blue collar job kind of thing, wearing my little hat and my suspenders or whatever. But I didn't see that at all. I really saw that other explanation, that they were pursuing something that they felt that they should be pursuing, which was their interests and what made them feel fulfilled and what gave them some kind of meaning in the work that they do. Those by far were the biggest motivators in the context of being in an economy that they didn't necessarily see themselves fitting into and being able to achieve this sense of fulfillment that they do from doing these more unconventional types of jobs.
Another sort of big picture of your book is this idea of the science and art behind all of these jobs. And one of the interesting examples you use is with the butchery and the importance of knives as well as cutting. And so I was wondering if you could tell us more about that.
Yeah, they all talked about how people often say to them, like, oh, you guys are artists. Look at you. Look at what you do, the artistry of what you do. And they always disavowed that, you know, specific term that they are artists, but they all recognize that there is an art to what they do, the art of, as they often called it, and as I called it in the book. And again, while they are being creative and that there is creativity that enters into it, there's also this recognition of and respect for the science behind what they do, which really limits what they can do. And they all acknowledge that, and they respect it. So whether it's the flavor profiles of certain spirits, or whether it's the chemical combustion process that goes on with distilling, or whether it's human anatomy and somebody's hair, or whether it's just animals and what nature has given us with them, they're constrained by what they can do with that. On top of that, you have people who limit what they can do as well in terms of their own taste and what they want out of them. So they recognize all of these limits, but they really balance it with creativity that also has certain limits. They work within these, you know, these templates, really. Each one has a certain template, whether it be a recipe or whether it be a certain stylistic form that comes with a haircut, or again, whether it be something like the anatomy of an animal. And they kind of find little seams and creases where they could, you know, find something new out of that, and where they can innovate. And a big part of this, learning how to innovate and to be creative, is to really master the embodied knowledge that comes from being a professional. So a lot of that has to do with learning how to wield tools. And yeah, there's with the barbers and the butchers, obviously, you know, you're dealing with tools that can be very harmful. You know, knives, you know, sharp objects. And I think, are you referring to the point in the book where I cut my finger?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, I figured you were. So I was learning how to, that was to slice a cut of meat, a bottom round, for making beef jerky. Again, you have to use the whole animal, and this is a really excellent way to use the whole animal. It's not a very popular cut. You slice it up, it makes really good beef jerky. You can really upsell that beef jerky and make good profit from it. And it sounds like such a rote task, just slicing very, very thin cuts of meat. And it's not just the physical part. It was always impressed on me to think about the possible waste that you're creating as you're slicing this meat. Because again, one of the principles is to try to use as much of the animal as possible. So you're slicing this meat thinking you got to do it thin, not just because that's best to make jerky out of. Jerky is easier made when it's thin, but also because you're potentially wasting this product, right? Waste this animal, which is one, bad for the bottom line, but it's also not adhering to the principles upon which this business exists. So I have all these ideas in my mind as I'm trying to slice this thing. And, you know, it's easy to forget about one of them. And I forgot one of the technical aspects of it, which is always know where your other hand is. So that didn't work out well. So I sliced off a solid chunk of my right pinky finger while I was doing that. And that was just me being a novice, and it being one of my first times doing this, slicing bottom round for beef jerky. But even professionals get to points where they screw up, you know, where they're off, their internal clock is off, or their sense of where they are in space is a little bit off. So your feet being a little bit too far apart, and all of a sudden you stab yourself in the leg, or you're using a pair of scissors that is just a half inch longer, and all of a sudden you cut a guy's ear or something like that. So it really is very much about having your mind and body being in sync and in a very particular rhythm with each other, which you're going to get over time. You're going to, if you focus on it and you concentrate on it, you attune your body to being able to accomplish these tasks with confidence and consistency.
Great, thank you. One of the aspects I hadn't thought about before reading your book is this idea of how these workers teach customers about this culture around these food products and drinks. And so I was wondering if you could tell us more about that.
Yeah, that was a really important finding. That was something that I learned pretty early on, was how important it was to these workers to teach their customers and clients about what they do, really, and about their own taste, to educate them, or as some of them put it, to train them to think about taste and style differently, so that when they go into these businesses, they are more informed. They're more informed about what they're going to order. They're more informed about what they like, and they could explain why they like it and what makes it good and what makes it high quality. So for these workers, it was a really important part of the job. It wasn't just cutting the meat or making drinks, but explaining why you're cutting this meat, why it's good, why you're making these drinks, why it's good, what's its history, why did I do this instead of that, why, what did that do to the final product, and why the whole thing is better than going to any other kind of bar. This was like a mission, so it was really kind of a big part of their jobs. And I start that chapter with a vignette from the butcher shop, and this happened all the time, that somebody would come in and they would look around, and there were just so many products in this display case, just like there were so many products behind the bar, and so many unusual tools at the barber stand, at the barber station, that they would inevitably, a customer would ask about it. And so they would often ask about, at the butcher shop I worked at, they would often ask about the chickens. Because they look like chickens. Everyone's seen a chicken, but they labeled it red cockerel. And everyone would be like, oh, what's a red cockerel? What is that? And that was the cue, and that was done intentionally. That was the cue to get the worker to be able to start that process of teaching, of educating. So they got to explain, oh, well, that's our type of chicken that we sell. We think it's the best. Here's why it's the best: because it's very tall and it has longer legs. You're going to get more dark meat, so it's really good for making soups. It's good for making roasts. And with that, they've communicated something. They've communicated variety within, you know, a chicken's a chicken, it is a chicken. But no, it's not. There's differences in chickens, and here's why this chicken's really good and why you should get it if this is what you're interested in. And it was more than just a conversation starter. These were little subtle hints and clues to alert customers and clients that something different is going on here, and two, to give these workers the opportunity to do that teaching process that they see as like a major mission of what these businesses are all about. And I saw that with each of these jobs in subtle ways, that they would try to get to their consumers somehow and do the best they could to even subtly try to teach them a little bit about what they were all about, what these businesses were all about.
Great, thank you. So another big picture from this book is this idea of the technical skills behind these jobs, as well as the cultural repertoire that the workers have to bring to it. Another interesting sociological aspect that I found was this idea of community. So the folks that work together, they, you know, try to enhance each other's skills. So I was hoping you could tell us more about that.
Yeah, this was a really important chapter when I was conceiving it, because when you think of these jobs, you sometimes just think of the technical part of it, like, oh, butchers cut meat, barbers cut hair, distillers make booze, and bartenders serve drinks. And that was an important aspect of doing these jobs. You had to know these technical skills, and in each case, they required, you know, a broader set of technical skills. You had to know more advanced techniques in order to do them. And that was all very important, but I noticed that it wasn't just people who had technical skills who were able to get these jobs and to succeed in them, but you had to have these other repertoires in your arsenal. You had to be able to very convincingly and effectively and efficiently perform the more cultural aspects of the work. So sure, that included the technical side, which included this sense of craft and this understanding of, like I mentioned before, innovating on certain templates. You had to kind of understand that. You had to perform that. That was all very important. But it was also the cultural understanding behind what makes these products, services, jobs, and businesses special, more special than the more common versions of them. And that's where I started to see these workers, I started to see them really learn from each other within these environments. They were designed and really intended to be not just learning spaces for consumers, but also for the workers themselves to build from the sets of knowledge and skills that they were cultivating. But it's also where I learned that if these jobs are as much cultural performances as they are just doing certain physical tasks, then they become something that people cannot do because of their own social and cultural backgrounds. And that's where I started to really realize where this sense of inequality comes into play in jobs like these. If you don't have the cultural reference points, say, that these businesses are based on, many put it in terms of the aesthetics of it, if you don't look like us and sound like us, then you're not going to be able to do it. You're not going to be able to really communicate the knowledge and the culture that these businesses are all based on, or at least you're not going to be able to do it very effectively, no matter how good you are at the more technical side of things. So it's really in that chapter where I wanted to kind of really communicate that and convey some of the issues that we see in a lot of these jobs and the revival of a lot of these traditionally low status blue collar jobs.
Great, thank you. So to sort of wrap up your book at the end here, you talk about the rise of these new elite jobs, as well as the sort of shift in the understanding of taste and consumption, especially, you know, settled into this idea of how cities are gentrified and what's becoming a good job in the new economy. So I was wondering if you could sort of give us a big picture here.
Yeah, I mean, these jobs wouldn't exist if there wasn't a consumer base and a market for them, if there wasn't a group of people who had some kind of interest in, or at least I should say, a resistance towards or antipathy towards mass production, or just wanting to see authentic products, right, quote-unquote authentic products, and to learn more about the origins of what they're consuming. And I think cities have become, you know, real repositories for these forms of consumption and these lifestyles, at the same time as they've become, you know, places where good jobs have proliferated. And what is a a good job. Well, you know, a good job is one that has traditional criteria like pay and benefits and so on, but also some other criteria like whether a job is actually stable or whether a job is going to give a worker autonomy over their work, or whether a job is going to be flexible or something like that. And in creating, you know, good jobs, of course, you know, we also have bad jobs, and bad jobs are going to be the ones that aren't necessarily stable, that aren't really flexible, that don't give you autonomy, that don't allow you to be creative, at the same time as they usually don't pay you very much, and they don't really give you benefits. So when we have far more bad jobs, and usually these jobs are in service or they're in retail or something like that, but with an interest in these forms of consumption, of knowing about the origins of products, of having products that are so-called authentic and that are of a high quality, that are artisanal, that are handmade and all this stuff, it really creates the opportunity to turn some of these so-called bad jobs into good ones by really kind of reinventing them around these performed cultural repertoires, right? That require a certain amount of knowledge, that require a certain amount of skills, and that require you to be able to communicate this knowledge and these skills to people. So these jobs really kind of show the potential for bad jobs to not just be felt as good, but to actually be good jobs, for these jobs to get higher status, to be seen as something that is a worthwhile pursuit, to get acknowledged for being an influencer of culture, to be a shaper of taste. And I think that these jobs do hold that potential. But again, if the successful performance of these jobs are in part based on cultural aspects and social aspects, then you're going to get to a point where you're excluding large groups of people. So we have to be, you know, a little cautious to say that these are, you know, viable paths for lots of different people, like mass production jobs used to be, because there are a lot of obstacles that are in the way. But I think we're seeing for certain segments of the population in cities mostly, these have become good jobs in a place where we would be unlikely to really see them. We normally think of good jobs today as being knowledge-based, technology-based, dealing with ideas or dealing with high-end services. These are not what we normally think about, but they've really entered into that conversation for, again, just a select segment of the population. So,
great. Thank you so much again for being here today. I was wondering if you could tell us what you're working on now.
Yeah, I've started a new project for the last few months or so. I mentioned in the beginning that I moved a bit north of the city and upstate New York into the mid-Hudson Valley. And the Hudson Valley is a fascinating place for, well, not just its history, but today it's starting to really become revived, and the source of the revival in many cases is people who are leaving New York City, mostly because of how unaffordable that it's becoming. And as mostly still young people are reaching a point where they want to settle down and start a family and have a house and all that stuff, you know, they're fine. And, you know, the schools for their kids and have a certain life for their family and for their kids. They're realizing that they're not able to do it in New York City, but there are some affordable and good, safe, interesting, historic places just north or just west or just east or just south of the city that they could go to. And I'm studying a particular place, a city called Newburgh, which is along the Hudson River, about 60 miles north of New York City, that is experiencing this transformation. And it really kind of combines my two books, this last one and my first one. I mentioned the first one was about conflicts over growth policies in gentrifying neighborhoods. And then obviously the second one is about these old craft-based jobs that are becoming cool. And really at the heart of Newberg's revitalization is this creative economy, these creative jobs, craft jobs, light manufacturing, also artists, people like graphic designers, people who are involved in the digital economy in some way, makers who are moving to Newburgh. It's because it's very affordable. It had seen a very, very steep decline over the final decades of the 20th century, and now a lot of its revival is coming from this creative, craft-based sector that I looked at in New York City, and a lot of them are people who were priced out of New York City or just saw the writing on the wall and decided they were going to start up their business or just make their living up there in Newburgh. So my project really looks at how small cities are growing and surviving and reacting to life in today's new economy. So that's the direction that project is going in now.
Great. Thank you again so much for being here, and thank you to our listeners.
Oh, thanks for having me, Sarah. I appreciate it. Thank you.